everyone. Welcome back to Not About the Weather. This is episode 8 of our fun little new show. And this week we have a very special guest with us to talk about some really cool things about fandom and television and all of your favourite things. So my name is Natalie. I am your lead host this week, as is relatively normal. And Not About the Weather, in case you're only just tuning in for the first time, is our new general interest pop culture commentary show in which we get together to talk casually about things that we are loving and not loving in life this week, coming from the original umbrella of our other podcasting family, Not Another Teen Wolf podcast. But there is no Teen Wolf here today. It is all Not About the Weather, and we are joined by Ariana, one of our regular hosts here on the Not About the Weather team. And we're also joined by screenwriter Davey Perez, who is working currently on season 12 of Supernatural, as well as a fun history that we want to talk about with some other shows and work as a television writer. So it's very exciting to have Davey here today as one of our first official interviews for Not About the Weather, and we hope that you like the format that we're going to present, because he's going to just join us for our hypes and gripes, but the hypes and gripes are going to be kind of all about him, so that should be exciting. As usual, if you want to get in touch with us, you can reach us through the Hub website for our podcast group, which is natwpodcast.com. Easiest place to find everything about both of the shows that we do under this umbrella. But if you want to get in touch directly, you can find us on Twitter at natwpodcast. Same on Facebook, facebook.com/natwpodcast. Instagram, Gmail as well. And then the website where you can find the actual episodes is notaboutthewetherpodcast.com, which you can also follow as a Tumblr account if you want. So, Ariana, I'm really glad that you're joining me today for this joint interview. We've never interviewed someone together before, have we?
No. I'm sure there's a lot of things we have never done before, Natalie, so this will be exciting.
I suppose that's true.
Hey, you guys know I'm right here, right? Just yes. Want to make sure.
Yep. So
that conversation down the certain road.
Just, you know, we're just doing our prep work right now. So, yeah, so what are we going to ask? No, so Davey is here. So Davey Perez is here as well with us, obviously. He's going to be talking to Ariana and I today on the podcast. And so Davey is a screenwriter, LA-based, as so many of you are, and he's working currently on Supernatural and comes to that show from two seasons of American Crime, which is a very, very different kind of show. But Davey, do you want to tell us a little bit about yourself, and then we'll get into a little bit about the differences in your experiences on both shows in order for us to speak more deeply about the specific issues we wanted to touch on.
Yeah, absolutely. And thank you for having me as part of this amazing podcast that you put on. You called me a screenwriter, which was kind of interesting because I'm used to being called a writer or being called, a lazy bum, but never a screenwriter. That was, I think, the first time someone actually said it so formally. It sounds great. I'm going to put it on my business card.
I'm not from, this world. Ariana is also a Los Angeles.
I'm not from this world either.
Native.
I'm just a wannabe.
Well, she's a Los Angeles native, and she's trying to work in writing as well. But I don't know. Is there a difference between?
I'm busting your chops. I mean, I think everyone has gotten used to the shorthand of writer out here in on the West Coast. A screenwriter. I think it tends to lean towards like the people who write the big feature films. We're all writers. I'm just nitpicking. I'm just teasing you.
Oh, no.
I have four sisters and I like teasing. So
no, it's good. It's I was just curious if there is an actual like industry difference between those terms at all. For a screen.
If there isn't a difference, I'm going to make one, and I'm going to make it hard and attainable. You have to like go through five hoops before you can get to screenwriter. But anyway, that was a very long sidebar. So I will answer the question, which was a little bit about myself and how I kind of got here. So I'm from LA, born and raised, but more on the east side of town. Had no connection to the entertainment industry whatsoever. as a kid, I, you know, wanted to be an actor, I think like a lot of people do. And I ended up taking classes at the Playhouse West Repertory School, which at the time I was there, James Franco was also a student, and he was really good. And I would go to watch him.
Really?
Yeah, he was. You know, he might have had some talent. But, you know, I was surrounded by a lot of really great, talented individuals, but also was, because of that, able to recognize that I didn't want to be on stage. I didn't want to be the character inside the story. I wanted to tell the story. I wanted to be on the other side. And even then, it was kind of a long journey. I worked on set as a PA. I was a production coordinator. And, you know, through working up the ranks, was able to get a job as an assistant at ABC Studios, which led to eventually working as a writer's PA on a show called My Generation, which, if anyone remembers that show, it was ahead of its time. Oh, there you go. Ahead of its time, I think it aired two episodes, and the showrunner for that show was Noah Hawley. And that same showrunner is the guy who created Fargo for FX. Mm-hmm. And so I got to, you know, meet him on My Generation, kept, you know, in loose contact. And then when he had Fargo moving forward, I was able to be his assistant and see that whole first season come together. And at that same time, my own writing career was gaining steam, and I signed with a manager. I got into the ABC writing program, and through the program was then staffed on American Crime. So it was like a 10-year overnight success kind of story.
Wow. So that's really interesting. The writing program is something that we want to talk about at length, later in the episode, as its own thing, because I feel like it's something that like everyone inside the industry knows about, and then no one outside the industry knows it's a thing. Because, for example, Brittany, who is one of our other hosts, who was originally going to be on this show, she's the first person that ever mentioned that to me, just as a thing she'd done. And I'm like, that's a thing? Like, I'm Australian, yeah, as well, so it's not like that in touch with it. But I do, you know, I've been reviewing television for 5 years, and I didn't know it was a thing. And because I'm not a writer, like I'm a columnist. I'm not a fiction writer. It's not in me to do that. So it's not something I've ever explored. And I just found that amazing, those network writing programs. I'd never heard of it. So I'm really curious to talk more about that. Ariana has experience in applying for that and is interested in that world for herself. So definitely going to go into that.
Yeah, definitely. We'll get into the specifics of it. Just sort of building off what you said, though, I wasn't aware of any of the access programs until 2009, really, you know, and they're programs that have been around for a very long time. You know, the DGA, most of the studios, the PGA, everyone has their own sort of version of whatever kind of job you're trying to get into, you can gain access to it. I don't know why they're not, you know, promoted on a grand scale, or if it's something that is intentionally, if you want it bad enough, you have to seek it out.
Yeah.
But I can say that for me, you know, both the first job as an assistant at ABC and the writing program itself were due to these inclusion access programs. And so if it wasn't for that, I would still be, you know, collecting trash on a set somewhere and a very unhappy PA.
So that's one thing that I wanted to talk about, just as an introductory little portion of the interview, because it's something that we're going to throw back to, I think, when we talk about the different shows. And I think that the Fargo aspect is really interesting to include as well, being a showrunner's PA, because I'm in fairly regular contact on Twitter with Andrew Dabb's PA, actually. We follow each other and stuff. So
you're talking about John Bring or Megan Fitzmaurice?
Megan. So what I'm curious about is the structure of your experience with the different kinds of writing rooms and environments for a showrunner to work with a team. My other show that I've done heavy coverage on is MTV's Teen Wolf. I have an incredibly long relationship with that show and with those writers, and I have been to their writing room several times, and they have a situation where they literally, their offices, they own their own set. They don't work on a studio. They own a mm-hmm. building that they have a set in. They have their offices there. The writers are on set, and they walk downstairs and they're filming. And then there are other shows that have For example, Elementary, again, one of our hosts was telling me that show, they produce and write in LA, they film in New York, but they fly the writer to the set for each episode. And then some shows, the writers never see the set. And at some shows, the writers all sit in the room with the showrunner and the whole team creates the story for the whole season and then assigns episodes out, but it is really a group effort. And then some things are completely done in a bubble, if you know what I mean. Obviously, you know what I mean. But so what has been the experience for you for each of them? We'll say Supernatural, American Crime and Fargo, you know, obviously working as a showrunner's assistant. What were the environments like for the different shows, and what one do you think works the best, or the pros and cons of each?
For sure. You know, I've actually had access to, you know, on a personal level, about 4 writers' room total for dramas and about 2 comedy writers' rooms. And you'll always hear this, and it's very true that, you know, every writer's room is different and it depends on what the showrunner wants to do and how the showrunner works. You hear horror stories and then you hear, you know, dreamlike scenarios of each sort of situation. I can only speak to the specific ones that I've experienced, which to me have all been different, but all seem in their own way very productive and very great ways to work. You know, the first writer's room that I ever gained access to was that My Generation room. And I only bring it up because it directly relates to, you know, it's the same showrunner. The way that Noah ran My Generation was vastly different from the way he ran Fargo. On My Generation, you know, the writer's room was kind of more formal. There was a bigger group of people. You know, they were in the room by 10 o'clock and they were all, you know, breaking story and talking about, you know, the season as a whole, and then breaking episodes together. And then, you know, a writer would get assigned an episode and they would take the helm. And if I remember correctly, the writers would then fly to set for their episode as it was being filmed. And I, at the time, was responsible for getting them all lunch. So I would, you know, wouldn't spend too much time inside as they were having those creative conversations. But when I could, I would, you know, poke my head in. And on Fargo, it was interesting because, you know, he had what is called like a mini breakout room, mini camp, sort of, because he didn't know if the series was going to get picked up or not. And he had a couple consulting producers come on board, and they all sort of helped him out with this general sense of where the season was going to go. And then he himself would write, you know, every episode of that first season. And he had about, I think he had 3 episodes written and some outlines before. And it was like, you know, they're either going to pick up the whole series or they're not. It wasn't about shooting a pilot like normally. It was all or nothing. And so for that experience was actually really great for me because, you know, he had his consulting producers for, I think, about 10 weeks, maybe 12. I can't remember specifically. But once they were gone and he was writing, I was essentially the only one there for him to kind of, you know, here, read this. And I would be able to see the progression of his first draft to the second draft.
Yeah.
And he was really, you know, being younger and naive that I was, I often would want to add my ideas and be like, hey, I read it, I really liked it, and did you think about this? And he was very gracious in that he would kind of look at me and be like, yeah, this doesn't work for this reason. And I'd be like, oh, that's right, okay. Versus like, get out of here, who are you, just get my coffee, you know. Or like, you know, on occasion, on the rare, you know, culmination of the right position of the sun and the moon and the stars, he'd be like, oh, that's actually really cool. Yeah, let me see what maybe I'll use a little bit of that. And so that was very much, I think, more of a cable model where you see, you know, one or a smaller group of writers that are responsible for, you know, a shorter order. Like, you know, you're not writing a potentially 20 episodes that season, you're writing a specified 10, and you know that's your number.
Yeah.
You're not expecting a back 9 to show up out of nowhere. And American Crime, it was sort of a hybrid. It was sort of a very different room again. One thing that Fargo and American Crime had in common was none of the scripts had act breaks. They were just written as, you know, 52 to 50, you know, however many pages long they were. And that was it. And the act breaks would be found in the directing of scenes or in the editing. Yeah. The other thing was, you know, Noah saw Fargo as a 10-hour movie, essentially, that had moments that would be self-satisfying as one-hour pieces. And that's the same approach we took with American Crime. It was meant to be a high-end cable drama that just happens to be on broadcast. Mm. And John Ridley, who's, you know, was amazing, experienced and talented guy, had a very strong vision for the kinds of stories he wanted to tell and how we were going to tell those stories. And we would sit in a room, a group of writers, six of us, I think, six or seven of us, and talk about the characters and talk about the character journey. And we would spend time just talking about the character for, you know, a good week. And then we would talk about, okay, what are the moments that need to happen for this character journey? And over the course of about 2 months, maybe 3 months, we would break out more like 2.5 months. We would break out the entirety of the season as we see it, you know, the current iteration of what we see the journey being. And then he would assign us episodes, you know, where he felt our voice would be most appropriate for what was being, you know, expressed. And we would then break out and we wouldn't meet again as a group unless we organized it ourselves and wanted to get pizza somewhere. We were essentially working with him directly and writing our outline based on the beats that we know we had already worked out with him. And it was interesting because it was at that point it went from like working on a TV style room to working on a film, kind of, because you have your producer, director, visionary who's now working with you as the writer to make sure that you're getting, you know, the beats down and the moments down that he's working towards.
That's really interesting, because to me, American Crime also feels like one long movie. And so that's really interesting that, like, you didn't read the person who did episode 4 before you wrote episode 5. Because to me, it just flows so well, each one into the other.
I mean,
I guess that would be John.
A lot of that, yeah. A lot of credit to John for continuing that storyline and strain and weaving those in together. And I mean, to a degree, you kind of knew story-wise what was happening before your episode, and you kind of knew story-wise where it was leading up towards. But there was a little bit of you know, hoping you get close to the target, you know, trying to, you know, and usually less is more, I would think, in a lot of those things. It's like, well, you know, if you can just think about the simple emotional moment that we're trying to work towards, because especially the type of storytelling, it wasn't about these big, you know, who shot JR moments. It was just about, you know, where's the disconnect between the characters this week, and mining all of that and mining, you know, one moment lasting for the whole episode, essentially, and how they're emotionally going to respond, and leading up to, you know, someone making some kind of a decision or accepting some kind of information that is not what they want to hear, you know? So it was kind of cool to work on some simpler level and some more grounded, slower type burn material. And, you know, I really loved working with John, and I really loved working with all the writers and directors. And it was a high-end sort of dream situation, and the cast was all very stellar. It, to a degree, it's like one of those types of jobs that you hope to be able to get someday at the end of your career or in the middle of your career. So for me to have it be like the first one out the gate, it was very exciting, and just, you know, I was very fortunate. And it essentially boiled down to the studio took too long to pick up episode or season 3. And being a young writer, you know, I just got married, you know, my wife is actually expecting a kid now. And, it, you know, if we went further and in depth into my backstory, you know, I don't come from a wealthy family that could support me as I try this mm-hmm. actor thing out or this writer thing out. It's all been self-motivated and it's all been, you know, working and hustling. And so I unfortunately didn't have the position to sit there and wait for the phone to ring and but you know, the fortunate surprise out of all that was that, you know, in that interim of waiting for American Crime season 3 to be officially picked up or not, you know, Supernatural had these needs. They were turning over the writing group here, and I was available, and Andrew Dabb read a sample of mine, and I came in to meet, and I got the job here, and you know, it's been a totally different type of room, but exciting and fun, and I'm really grateful because it's only making my own writing stronger, and it's also stretching me out and helping me to meet a whole new group of people and meet a whole new network of studio executives. And there's only positive things that have come out of this because, you know, I'm still very close to all the people that are writing on American Crime. And now I'm also getting very close to the people here in Supernatural. To just finish the thought of on writing rooms, the way we function here is completely different than everywhere else. Surprise, surprise. So, and it was kind of a fun shock, I would say, to discovering the method here.
This is the thing I'm really curious about. Sorry to interject. And because this is actually, Supernatural has had four showrunners, basically, over the 12 seasons. And it's, you know, different writers who've come and gone on the show have had different things to say about the process. And so my main question and you know, curiosity in asking you about that is whether that is still the same process or whether each showrunner has changed. Before we came on the call, Ariana was talking about, like, I think hearing a podcast with a former writer who was in season 7, and that was two showrunners ago. That was Sarah Gamble's writing room, and her writing room apparently was very different to others. So obviously this is Andrew Dabb's first season, though he's been there as a staff writer for however long, like, you know, 8 or 9 years.
Right.
So I'm very, very curious about what you do when you get up and go to work with the team and how Dabb operates as a showrunner, like whether it's on the set or in LA, if you know what I mean.
Of course. You know, while I wasn't here for any of the previous regimes, as they would say. So I can't speak to how the you know, that sort of process was, but I can definitely share, you know, how the sausage is made now.
Yes.
So there's this big steel cage in the middle of the building with chainsaws, and there's Tina Turner's there, and it's two man enter, one man leave. No. So you know, Andrew is very much a writer's writer, and I think you know, he has flown up to set, I believe, you know, about 3 times now. He tends to go up, I think, when they're doing the bigger episodes, you know, the season premiere, the mid-season finale, those kinds of things. But as far as, you know, where his focus is, most of it is here in LA.
Yeah.
And it's, you know, and rightly so, because there's a lot of moving pieces here, and you want, you know, to make sure that the captain of the ship is always on deck, you know. And so what I discovered here when I came in, you know, I showed up on the first day and I thought, oh, well, you know, there's going to be a week of getting to know people, and then maybe there'll be another week where we goof off and put ideas up on the board, and then, you know, we'll talk about our day, and then eventually we'll get down to some script assignments. Little did I know. So on day one, you know, we all sat down, and Andrew and Robert Behrens, and then Eugenie and Brad, who kind of were carrying over from last.
They're the only remaining writers, correct? They're the only ones that were there before 12.
Exactly. Yeah. So they had the benefit of already knowing from last season kind of what this season was going to look like a little bit. So they just essentially, all three of them, sat with us, the three new writers, myself, Steve Yockey, and Meredith Glenn, and said, this is what we're doing. This is the mythology. This is kind of where we're going to take it. We got all that sort of worked out, and we need you to come up with some standalone episodes and let us hear what you got in 2 days. So I was like, what? Pardon me? So we had essentially like, you know, 2.5 days to come in with, you know, 4 to 5 minute pitches for general story arenas. And we just had to come in and not have it so detailed and thought out, but just have the nuts and bolts of what could possibly be an episode. And then from that, you know, Andrew kind of soaks it all in, and him and Robert Singer decide, you know, what would be best that to kind of fit in with where their moving pieces are. And you get an episode assignment, and you work right away, and you start on the outline, and you have, you know, the normal turnaround time for that. You know, you have your week for the outline and your 2 weeks for the, you know, first draft and all that. So other than that, there is no formal writer's room. It's not like we all go in and say, oh, you know, let's break episode 10 together. Yeah, or, oh, yeah. It's very much, look, we hired you because you have a voice, and we thought that that voice would be good for our show. You know the show's rules, you know the confines of what we're doing. So if you have any questions, we're here. And, you know, I'll very maybe too often go and pop my head into Andrew's often and be like, so I'm kind of thinking that maybe this, and does that work? And he'll be like, eh, that doesn't work, but maybe this. And I'll be like, okay, good. That sounds better. Thank you. Or, you know, if he's not available, the other writers are certainly here, and we're all kind of simultaneously working on our stories, and we'll kind of do you have a minute, do you have a second, can I pitch you my board before I fall on my face before Andrew and Bob? And so it's kind of exciting because there is that community of the writers are very accessible. They're just two doors down if you need them. We all have lunch together. We're all having conversations about what we're working on, but when it comes to actually breaking it and writing it, it's totally yours to take some ownership on, and you just, you know, go and have fun with it.
That's so interesting, because, and I want to talk about that more when I talk about the continuity, which is something that I want to talk about in a little while, but it's just so like viscerally opposite of, as I mentioned, Teen Wolf. The reason this podcast exists is because we had a very, very, very successful long-term coverage of MTV's Teen Wolf. We know the showrunner very well, and then the show is cancelled.
You keep plugging it though, so that's great.
I didn't mean to plug it in that way. It's just that this episode chops. Will have a lot of new listeners, you know, because I'm going to promote it to the, you know, the Supernatural people, in, you know, because I write the Supernatural features, but a lot of the general listeners who would be listening right now are people who come from our podcasting
I've heard a lot of really good things about Teen Wolf.
The only reason I'm mentioning it is because it's my main experience with the writers' room, and they have like literally the opposite of everyone. You know, even so and so's name is on an episode, but they perhaps did not come up with every idea in that episode. It's, you know, right. It's all done as a group, and then they go and fill it in later. So it's just the scope of difference between the different kind of you know, shows, and it's not even like genre specific. It's like, you know, just different people and the ways that shows are done, like that is really interesting to me.
Oh, I mean, yeah, absolutely. I again, like, not from personal experience, but anecdotally, I know of or have heard of situations where everyone's essentially put in a blender and you all work on things, and then the showrunner says, okay, your name's going on that one, your name's going on that one, your name's going on that one. And, you know, there could possibly be an episode where you literally wrote like two scenes, yet that's the one your name's going on because it's your turn in the rotation. Thankfully, that's not the process here at all, which is, as a writer and someone who wants to be recognized in an egotistical fashion, it's a blessing to have, you know, from day one when I met with Andrew, one of the things he said that got me excited about it was like, no, we want people that have an interesting take on things and an interesting voice and to have ownership to the kinds of stories that they're telling. So,
and
yeah.
I think that's really great for Supernatural specifically has picked up on that, because screenwriters, again, are something that I feel like in not every show that I watch or even movies get enough credit in terms of, you know, when something is meaningful, like, you know, something that they love about a character or whatever, you know, it, for me, generally comes down to the writing, and it's not something that's always talked about. But with this show, with Supernatural, it is. People have favorite writers. They know in certain writers' episodes, you know, that they love certain takes on the character. They know that you've mentioned in interviews before, that when you caught up on Supernatural, that you were really drawn to Andrew's episodes, and so am I, even before he was the showrunner. His interpretation of Supernatural is my favourite interpretation of Supernatural, mm-hmm. so I'm glad that he is now the showrunner. But that's something to talk a little more about with the continuity, because I'm very curious, because it's such a long-running show, and that the, you know, the actors are so protective of these characters they've been crafting for 10 right. years. Having such, you know, individual takes, you know, how does that stay consistent? But we'll talk about that momentarily when it's my turn to do that.
I think we should just do that now, Natalie. That's a good segue. Let's talk.
All right, if you'd like to.
I'm here for whatever you want to do, Natalie. Okay. I know I can be cheeky, but I'm actually very easy to get along with.
No, I'm totally happy.
You've been very difficult so far, so.
I can tell. I'm sorry.
The only reason I put mine second is because it throws into Davies a little, but we can do that and then do yours. It'll be fine. So, we'll talk about that in that case. We'll go into the main body of the episode, which is, as I like to call it in terrible phrasing, an obsession to share and a grievance to air, which is our main, how we usually structure the show. We get together and talk about something we like, something we don't.
Is there a bell that goes off like ding, 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 ding?
No, but there needs to be.
I mean, there will be now.
You are the idea man today.
So, just, you know, that one's free, guys. That one's free. Don't worry about that one.
So my hype, basically, my hype for the week, having Davey here, is well-executed continuity throwbacks. So I think Ariana's right. It is a good segue from what I was just talking about, because you know, Davey came on to Supernatural this season for season 12, as he's mentioned, as a new writer, and we've heard about that. We've heard about the writer's room setup. And his episode, the first one that he's created this year, was American Nightmare, which was episode 4 of this season. And I really, really loved it. I wrote not a recap of it, but a column about it, which I've been doing for the episodes this season. And it includes throwbacks to issues from, you know, issues from the past, from far back in the past of Supernatural, in terms of Sam's psychokinetic powers that he's had in the past and stuff like that. That's referenced in the plot of this episode with his interactions with the psychic girl Magda. And there have been various, you know, naturally psychic characters on the show before as well, but Sam hasn't always made that connection back to his own problems or powers or whatever you want to call them. So I was just curious, like, when you're coming into a show like this one, Supernatural is obviously 12 years of canon.
Right.
With these characters that are so very, very, very well known to the audience and well known to the actors. And so I'm just wondering about the, I know that they have sort of continuities checkers, that there's like writer's assistants to do that right. kind of thing. But I'm wondering, when you come into a show like this, like Supernatural, because the difference, I think, with American Crime, which I loved, but as an anthology show, the episodes I saw, you were right, so high end. But as an anthology show, it's like new characters every season that you're creating. You've right. got these 12, you know, characters that have been going for 12 years. When you come in and start writing for the show, is there any kind of, like, spec of, like, okay, this is their personalities, this is what they're like, this is how they'd react to things, this is how they act, this is how they pretend to act, and this is what they really feel, if you know what I mean? You know, there's the kind of
spec. Yeah,
do you know what I mean?
I get the question.
Long-term character development that has gone into the show, how a new writer handles getting that right.
Right, exactly. Well, first of all, who's to say I got it right? So there's that.
Yeah.
No, I mean, there isn't a master template or a sort of roadmap as far as, you know, this is what you need to do or the best way to do it. I think the sort of roadmap or templates for that would be to just watch the episodes themselves and, you know, to kind of find for yourself as a writer what resonates most with you that you think you could bring out and write towards, you know?
Yeah.
When I did come on board, you know, obviously I was familiar with the show to a degree, and I knew enough about the characters and the world to kind of speak competently enough that I got the gig. But, you know, getting the gig and writing for the show is two different things. So in preparation, the production and put together, and I'm not actually sure who generated the list, but the list existed somewhere, of essentially for nuts and bolts mythology reasons, these are the 20 to 25 episodes you should probably watch, just so you can know over the past, you know, 12 years, what are the big kinds of things that have happened? What are the big kind of moments that the brothers have gone through? Being that the show is largely a standalone type format, you know, there is a string or two that runs through each season, but they're not serialized. It's not like the primary focus becomes, you know, like we know there's Leviathans, but not every episode is about stopping the Leviathans. So there is a kind of a thread that if you watch these four in this season, and you'll understand kind of what they did that season for the big. And then, you know, using that as the jumping off point, I then as an individual would then kind of say, well, you know, I'm interested in werewolves, and I would go and luckily there's a lot of online resources thanks to the fandom, and you can just literally type what are the werewolf episodes in Supernatural, and there'll be this list, and you'll be okay, let me watch these werewolf episodes and let me learn about that lore. For my episode specifically that's dealing with psychics, I, you know, watched all of the psychic episodes that I could, and I, you know, very much the early episodes revolved around Sam. And just as a writer, you know, I naturally want to make sure that I'm servicing characters whenever I can. And so my instinct was just like, you know, if that were me and I had this past of dealing with the psychic ability that really screwed with me, if I came into contact, you know, let's say I was a kid who almost drowned. If I met a victim of a drowning accident, I would bond with that person. I would want to talk about it, you know. And that's kind of where that sort of impulse came out of, just my writing instincts of like, well, if Sam's confronted with someone who, whether it's psychic by birth or psychic because of some other means, it doesn't matter. It's the fact that they're dealing with something he understands on a personal level. And I think that's probably something that I kind of got right away about the show, is that, yes, it's about monsters, and yes, it's about, you know, good and evil and, you know, moral dilemmas. But essentially, it's about these two brothers, and they're trying to do what they think is right. You know, they're trying to do their version of the greater good. And whether the greater good is really what's driving them, or if it's a personal vendetta, or if it's a, you know, they may not be aware of that as characters, but in their mind, it's always about, you know, and that's something I responded to, and I could understand, like, yeah, you know, you always want to be working towards these higher morals, and sometimes you can be blinded by that. So in writing how they approach, you know, their hunt, I was always, you know, trying to make sure that I gave them whatever ground that they're standing on is always going to be, they're in their mind doing the right thing.
Yeah, it's really interesting because you just mentioned the lore a lot, and I think that that is, you know, super important. But I was wondering kind of what episodes that you felt that you watched that really told you who the guys are the most out of.
I mean, a lot. I mean, immediately from the pilot, you know, I could tell the, you know, the family history, you know, between these two guys. And then, you know, the guilt of the, you know, I'm an older brother and I'm also a younger brother. I have two brothers. And so I understand the unique relationship you have when you're feeling responsible for someone. And then the unique relationship you have when someone feels responsible for you and is very interested in every choice you're making. And so I kind of tapped into the personal for that. And I picked that up immediately. A lot of season one episodes has that family dynamic as they're looking for John. Then there's another, some of the flashback episodes. There was one that reveals when Dean was in a foster
home.
Care.
Yeah, so good.
Yeah, yeah.
So good.
Yeah, and really, or even the one where they go back to high school and you see how, you know,
the posturing
Sam was always
gets
picked
called
on.
Out as well, and Dean's posturing gets called out really
yeah,
strongly
exactly.
by that
and,
girl.
And,
yeah, yeah.
It gets in, you know, the their usual roles get inverted, but just in that, you understand so much because not only do you understand, okay, Dean's being called out, but you also understand that normally Dean is the popular new kid who comes in, and normally Sam is the guy who's dealing with having no friends. But in this one, his particular instance, Sam was able to feel like the cool kid with some friends. Mm. Oddly enough, it was those kinds of peeks into their backstory that helped me to write them in the next.
Yeah, that's really cool, because I was saying this, cards on the table. Ariana's here because she's watched American Crime and she's interested in the shows. She's not a Supernatural watcher. She did watch your episode, but
Get out.
And
Ariana,
I'm a Supernatural watcher and don't know as much about the other work, because the high-end drama stuff is something that I sometimes don't feel quite smart enough to engage with properly. But I kind of like to, I always put it that, like, Sam is like a real hard ass kind of posturing as a sensitive new age guy, and Dean is a sensitive new age guy posturing as a hard ass, if you know what I mean. And that's kind
no,
of
yeah,
how I read them. And I think that this episode had a lot of that for both of them. You know, with Dean and Mary, he's very, very, very emotional. And then Sam really going off at the, you know, the family, at the mother,
right.
And really not holding back there and, you know, not handling it very sensitively, and, you know, not that it necessarily deserved to be handled sensitively, but really having that that harshness about him, which I really love.
For me, what was kind of fun about that was, you know, yes, you know, it's like you have this guy, Dean, who is supposed to be the, you know, stuff it down and don't talk about it, quote unquote, manly one, yet he's the one who's really wearing his heart on his sleeve. And really, and kind of like me, I really have no poker face. Like if I'm upset about something, people can usually tell that, okay, you know, and so he's, you know, brooding and, you know, he's very obviously thinking about his mother. And then you have Sam, who's supposed to be this buttoned up and, you know, more of the thinker kind of character. Yet, you know, once that, you know, scab gets peeled, it like lashes out in a way that you're just sort of, it's very powerful. And you know, that was, and I'm glad that you picked up on that, because that moment was meant as a trigger moment where, not only is he upset about the fact that here's a mother who let her daughter die, but he's also being upset because here's a mother who's not being there for their kid, much like my mother's not being there for me right now. And whether or not, you know, I'm not trying to get into, you know, the fairness of that for Mary as a character, whether she's meant to be there for them or not. But from their individual emotional perspectives, it's about, like, you know, our mother's here existing on the planet, and yet she's not here with us now, you know.
I think that, Sam is, you know, a much angrier character. Dean has, you know, with his father, as you mentioned, been treated pretty badly, always gave it a pass, but then always had issues because of it, and la la. And so the relation of that to Mary coming back is very interesting. But I was just curious about those continuity aspects being included, like the psychic, you know, the psychic throwback is pretty huge and made me pretty curious as well, given the like the Men of Letters reaction at the end to. To Magda, which is something else that we can talk about in a moment as well. And then I'm curious as well, going into what you wanted to talk about as your hype, which is the next upcoming episode, 12.12, which is, because this was a standalone. This one was, you know, Ariana, I think you watched this quite happily without, you know, just my random bits of commentary.
Only Supernatural episode.
Yeah.
It was delightful. I really enjoyed it.
I can forgive you now. If the only one you've watched is mine, then I'll forgive you.
I think, Ariana, you were saying that you felt pretty strongly about Dean and Sam's a relationship as an older sister as well. So there was definitely something there.
I really got it. I was like, oh, that's just like me and my sister.
I think, you know, anyone that's a sibling, or even if you have a best friend that has been a part of your life for a certain amount of time, there's a certain familiarity, and then there's a certain understanding that, you know, nothing's going to really, really tear us apart. But, you know, it doesn't mean that I accept you at all times. And you could just, you know, you get under each other's skin.
Yeah.
But, you know, but you love each other.
It's almost like because you know nothing's going to tear you apart, it gives you the leeway to be way harsher than possible. Right, yeah, exactly. Absolutely.
Right.
Absolutely.
I mean, not that that's always great, but yeah, you kind of, you know, you have a certain freedom to be candid and to be a little bit more uncensored, you know, and to sort of, you know, really let some emotions out that maybe you'd be reserved about if you were worried that you might really, you know, oh man, I can't. If I do this, this person will just get out of my life, you know?
Yeah. I was telling Natalie, I thought it was really cute when he was on the phone and he was calling him Sammy. This is all, which apparently happens all the time. Natalie was telling me.
It has a significance.
It's like, it's precious.
Yeah.
So I think that's what I do with my poor little sister, who's not little. She's 19, but I'm like, oh, my little sister. And then people expect to see a child and it's
right.
Not.
Yeah.
Well, you know, it's funny.
Grown woman.
Everyone has, you know, siblings always have a nickname for each other or a name, and you'll be surprised, you know, you're right. You're calling them that and you realize that, oh, she's actually, you know, 28 years old and I'm still calling her like she's four. But it's funny that you mentioned the Sammy thing too, because another writer friend of mine who's a big fan of the show and has watched it since, you know, it watches it live and has never missed an episode. Mm. When she found out I was writing on the show, she's like, she had some advice for me. She's like, look, when Sam gets in trouble, and it's going to happen, Sam's going to get in trouble, and Dean finds out about it, there's a progression. I'm like, what are you talking about? And she's like, no, it goes like this. It goes, Sammy.
and she's not wrong.
Yeah, and then I cracked up, and then I watched some episodes, and I was like, oh, wow, that's really cool. And I wanted to sort of incorporate a little bit of that in my own way. And so I immediately went to stage three with Sammy.
Yeah. I don't usually, like, I don't, one, I am a relatively recent fan of the show, and I don't find it repetitive. People, you know, come and go with the show because it's been going for so long. I watched it all in pretty much a bubble, like all... It took me about 4 months to watch the whole series, and I really enjoyed it. Didn't miss any episodes, and I didn't find it really repetitive. And one thing that you mentioned earlier about the it not being like ongoing stories all the time, about the different types of lore, is
right.
That it's not. But what I find very interesting about this show is, you know, it does feel like one long story in that every season's arc tends to be due to the problem of the former season, if you know what I mean. For example,
right.
You know, like, you know, season four happens because at the end of season three Dean goes to hell, and then you know the season eight happens because of the Leviathans. Leviathans happen, the finale, they do a thing, and then that begats the entire problem of season eight or whatever. So
you get rid of the Mark of Cain, and then
yeah,
that
and it opens up the Amara. Yeah. So I really loved those connecting threads and the sort of the long overarching thing that does feel like it's one story. And obviously having Mary back, given that her death like was the catalyst for the whole show, is bringing that back even more. So I feel like the continuity is really important in this show. So did you have any kind of issues with that? Like, you know, how is it checked on your end, if you haven't sat there and watched, you know, every episode, or even if you did, but you don't have like an encyclopedic memory, though I think that, you know, you should at some point, because there would be some really great things to pick up on.
Oh, yeah.
Little things, you know, what in the downtime, just start season one and just, you know, keep going in the spare time. Oh, wasn't that cute? Aren't they tiny? But, yeah, so with the continuity and stuff like that, how did that you find that, both with kind of, you know, whether it was through Andrew Dabb or through whatever, were there any, you know, moments they were like kind of, yeah, that's really good, or that's not right for that character, or, oh, that fact isn't right, or anything like that, like in the process of writing?
I can't really think of anything specifically. I mean, there certainly have been sort of little moments here and there, or more so like, you know, oh, you know, Dean might not say it this way. You know, I think my first draft was a little the words were a little proper, and maybe that was probably coming off of her writing from American Crime. You know, having a certain turn of phrase, a cadence, and just sort of say, no, these are two guys that are just hanging out in an Impala. Like, they don't need to always speak correct English. Mm. Oh, of course, right. I mean, we do have, like I said, you know, we have the online resources of all the fan conversations and the various Wikipedias that sort of give a lot of information. We have access to, you know, via Netflix or even screeners, any episode that we would want to watch. And, you know, John Bring is our writer's assistant here, and he's been here, I want to say, about 5 years now. Mm-hmm. And he has a lot of knowledge, and he can kind of point you in the direction sometimes. Or, you know, I did have like a question about Wiccan, and I wanted to know how many times it had been referenced, or had it been referenced in the show before. And John was like, you know, let me look that up. And he would actually research it, and then he kind of get back to me with it. And I think, you know, as with any kind of writing, when you're tackling the subject matter, you research it as much as possible so that you can get it right. So for me, you know, it was researching psychics on the show, which then gave me those episodes that Sam had the ability.
Yeah.
It was researching, you know, some of the witchcraft and the Wiccan. It was researching, you know, how he deals with emotional moments. And I think I was actually watching, it was, I'm so bad with specifics, but there was a couple episodes where he had a family of his own, and he was a stepdad to a guy, and watching him struggle emotionally with that helped me to see how the character might struggle emotionally with, you know, his mom leaving him. And essentially was stuff it all down, pretend it doesn't exist, you know? Which it was a good starting point, especially for that episode, because, you know, you really wanted to have the, What I noticed about the first couple of seasons, and even, you know, the later seasons, the episodes that I think are the most fun to watch are when the brothers aren't on the same page about something, and it's an emotional reason, or even if it's a pragmatic reason. But there's just whenever you can get them arguing over something, you know it's going to be good. You know there's going to be a good conflict, and the conflict's going to come from your two main characters that we're already invested in, and we're already interested in. So that's kind of what I wanted to do as far as how I was writing those scenes.
It's really interesting, and because what you mentioned as well, like with Dean and those when he was living his sort of normal life with Lisa and Ben, it's interesting as well, because then, you know, we're 6 years on from that. So like, how do you kind of look at that kind of thing and then go, okay, like, how do you stop it being regressive, if you know what I mean? How do you go, like, oh, he's actually grown from that, or if he hasn't, or if he has? Like, how do those decisions get made, if you know what I mean?
Well, for me, I think it's funny because I might have read it in a book somewhere, or maybe it was advice that I got in regards to writing television versus writing film. So when you're writing a film, you're writing what is hopefully a complete journey, where a character gets called to action, they go on their journey of discovery or their journey of, you know, tribulation, and then they arrive to an endpoint, and you find, oh, I've learned this lesson, or I've grown so much, and that was a satisfying closed-ended story. Television doesn't work that way. Television is about a character that you become invested in, you fall in love with, and that character grows in incremental ways. And not only do they grow in tiny little increments and that sometimes don't even grow, they go backwards. And so you don't close the loop. You keep the loop open so that hopefully, but when you know that, okay, this is our final season, our final run of episodes, that's when you can find those landing points. And that's when you can sort of say, this is the end of this journey. So as far as, you know, having to imagine what Dean might be 8 years ago, you know, all I could kind of say was like, well, that's who Dean is. You know, there's a well of knowledge to watch, and you can see that that's who he is. And maybe they've grown in some small way. You know, maybe Sam can talk about the psychic stuff where maybe before he didn't even want to talk about it, but he's not, you know, a completely different Sam in that he's, you know, learned from his mistakes and will never make the mistakes again.
Yeah.
You know, you want to make sure that, that you're staying true to who they are and allowing those characters to just live in those moments and, you know, to of course grow and have their journey, but to really take time and, in an essence, you enjoy those incremental growths and they mean so much more.
Mm. No, no, fair enough. And I think like quite a good example there is your episode, you know, Dean dealing with, you know, sending those text messages to Mary and having that little arc, which people really, really loved and found really, found very progressive for Dean in the way that he reacted, you know, and kind of came at peace with that. And then a couple of episodes later in Steve Yockey's episode, the Asa Fox episode, which was also fantastic, such a great episode, when actually faced with her, he basically like lost his shit. Like he was just like, got angry. And it's interesting because it didn't feel inconsistent. It felt like he thought he was okay with it. He thought he was okay with it. He thought he was okay with it. And then there she is. And it's like, fuck you. Sorry
for
the language, but I felt it was like very well done. So I was wondering about the continuity inside of the bubble of writing the season as opposed to like the throwbacks of, you know, yesteryear.
Well,
how do you go?
A lot of that is, for sure. A lot of that is, you know, Andrew Dabb is our supreme leader. I was about to say, as our showrunner.
Overlord.
Yes. our overlord and slave driver. But no, it's his overall vision and it's his making sure that the journey is going on its proper progression and also, you know, hitting the beats that need to happen. And then also it is, you know, Steve's an amazing writer and he's a playwright. So he knows how to really, you know, mine those moments. And it is knowing, you know, because we are just right across from each other, you know, we're reading each other's materials and him knowing, okay, you know, you had this really cool thing in your episode. I read the script and, you know, everyone's going to love this little moment and it's going to be this little feel good moment for Dean. And we're writing for television, so we can't let that be closed ended. So how can we reopen that wound? You know, how can we use that and build off that to now kick us off into a new story? And I think personally, I like that kind of writing better because it mimics real life to me. You know, all of us as individuals, you know, sometimes we feel like we learned the lesson, but then we really didn't learn that lesson. And we keep repeating those same mistakes until, you know, eventually over time we go, maybe that's not the right kind of, you know, lifestyle for me. So, you know, that moment with the phone is exactly that sort of over the phone and via text. He's being a little needy, which was out of character for him. And then he got a little sort of,
I don't think being needy is out of character for him. I think he's one of the neediest characters in television, but carry on.
Well, yeah, but I guess rephrasing that, you know, being so overtly needy.
That's true. Yes.
And self-aware. And, you know, that moment that he catches himself, he's like, God, that's such a needy thing.
Usually he's needy, doesn't admit to being needy, and just does terrible things because of it. So, yeah.
So there,
very needy.
He had a little moment and he had his little, okay. And then, you know, I, one of my favorite moments, and I'm glad that it was, you know, acted so well by Jensen was when he, when she finally does say, you know, I love you both, tell Sam, I love you. And Sam's like, what is it? And he's just like, nothing, you know, he's like, I'm going to keep this one for me. You know what I mean? It's just, this one's going to be all mine. And, you know, he doesn't. And also what that says is that, well, if I tell Sam that it's a text for mom, he's going to know I was texting mom and I don't want him to know all that. So, I think it was a very kind of true brothery kind of thing to do.
And that's an interesting thing that's continuing as well. And these are the things that I don't really know, you know, how intentional it's meant to be, you know, or because there's a lot with this show. You've got 12 years of show in which people, you know, debate whether something is intentional or whether it's coincidental. You know, this week's episode that just aired, The Rock Never Dies, again, they're in a better place, you know, Dean and Mary, but they're texting and Sam is checks in via Dean. Oh, you're texting mom? So the fact that Sam, you know, Dean is in constant contact with her now and Sam is not, is a very interesting thing to be an ongoing thread for me. So I'm curious about that relationship.
Well, and it's going to go, you know, obviously without spoiling anything, you know, I think the natural way, the flow of life too is, you know, with the interpersonal relationships, like a family, you know, there's a time where let's say there's two sisters. And at one point, the older sister is closer to the mom and the younger sister's feeling, the mom's favoring the older sister and blah, blah, blah. And then 4 months, 5 months down the line, for some reason, you know, now the younger sister has gotten the mom's attention and they're having this really great female bonding. And the older sister's like, hey, what happened to me? Mm. You know, and then it goes back. You know, it's depending on what's happening in everyone's lives or what's happening around everybody. I find it interesting, as children and as siblings, that rivalry is actually kind of present, whether you're aware of it or not. Mm. You know, and to kind of see Sam and Dean on that sibling rivalry journey has just kind of been fun.
Yeah, and with Mary especially, it's very interesting because Dean has consciousness of her person, you know, whether that consciousness is correct or not. Like, he has some, you know, outdated, you know, childish but very cherished, you know, memories of her, whereas Sam has nothing. It's like a brand new slate. So the way they relate to her is just very different, and it's very interesting. But moving on from that, because we've been talking about that for quite a while, carrying on with the continuity, your next episode, this one was a monster of the week. Your next episode is possibly more relevant to the overarching ensemble of the show, like at least it sounds like it. And I'm curious because, yeah, you've put down the 12.12, which is currently filming, is the next one that you wrote, and it's going to be epic, apparently. So I had a few questions about that, but do you want to tell us?
Of course.
Tell us about what you can say for now.
You know, it's funny because I can't say too much. I could say, you know, Richard Speight Jr. is the director, which is really a gift because he totally understands what the episode is doing and the importance of certain moments in the episode. Also, I know Misha tweeted out an image of himself in some version of disrepair. I guess the one thing I could clarify is I believe, you know, very early on, before we actually got into the breaking of the story and things shifted, there was this concept that this would be a story about Castiel's backstory,
yes, and it
would
reveal some of his history. And this is like, I was kind of like, did stuff get twisted around there? Because, there was originally Andrew saying that 12.12 was things from Cass's past, and then there was this casting of this other character, the Alicia Witt's character, which was meant to be from Cass's past, and then that was in 12.10 or something like that. Now, I sort of got a bit twisted, and the fact that if they're both Castiel-centric episodes, there's a lot of people will be very happy about that, but I'm curious about what's going on there.
Of course. What I can clarify is that episode 10, which Steve Yawkey wrote, will be the episode that gives us Castiel's history. And will let us know a little bit about his backstory and the things that help shape them as a character. Mm. And those things, of course, will fold into and tie into episode 12. And episode 12, Cass is definitely a focus of it. He's a main part of the story. And it'll be very apparent, you know, very early on in the episode of the stakes and what's important and how it's centering on Cass.
It's very interesting because, you know, I'm sure that you can't confirm either way, but and it's obviously Steve's episode that this may address. But the most interesting thing to, I think, a lot of fans about Cass, continuity-wise, which has never been picked up on again, was his arc in, I believe, the end of season 8 when he was sort of being brainwashed against his knowledge. There's a line by, one of the kind of, you know, fascist angels that's brainwashing him, saying that he's been wiped over and over again throughout history, that he was always this kind of rebel who objected to things that was going on, and that this kind of head being wiped clean in order to get him back to obedience had happened hundreds of times throughout history. And that's always been the thing I've been most curious about. So when we heard Castiel's backstory, that's where my mind's going. But I'm very curious to see what does end up going down. And your episode is obviously also being directed by Richard Speight, who, you know, as an actor has relation to, you know, his character, Gabriel, also has the huge relation to Castiel, but who's directed on the show without acting in it as well. So do you actually have any input working with the directors? Do they come into the office to work on what they're going to do before going up to shoot, or kind of how has that, what is the director relationship there?
It depends on the director and their style. You know, in television, you know, directors come in pretty far along in the process after the script has kind of gone into a production draft. And typically you'll get, you know, a tone call with them. Mm-hmm. You might get a couple email exchanges to answer some questions. And then you want to sort of trust in their vision and let them kind of take the reins and make sure that that you're giving them the space and the freedom to do the things that they have to do and be the voice for the actors. Mm-hmm. You know, some shows actually, you know, will have the writers on set. And even in that situation, you want to make sure that you're not, you know,
over.
You want the director to do their job and not be all over them. For this particular episode, with Richard, because of I'll say the unique nature of it, I reached out to him early and I said, hey, you know, I know you're not due to prep for a couple of weeks, but if you're interested, I can give you a peek at the script and I'm here to talk about anything that you might want to talk about. And he was got back to me right away and he was very gracious and he read it and he dug it a lot. And we actually got coffee and we had this really great conversation and it was really just fun to talk about this, awesome. The different things that we want to do for this. And then, you know, beyond that, I could tell right away he got exactly what this was supposed to be. And we had a tone call and, you know, again, just kind of vibed on each other on that tone call. And then really just took a little step back and let Richard do what he's got to do to make this what it's going to be. And I can tell you, I've been watching the dailies and I'm just completely thrilled and giddy with this stuff I'm watching. It's really good.
Yeah. And I mean, the other thing that was revealed about this episode is that it is an homage to a specific director, which given the title that has been released is now pretty obviously Quentin Tarantino, unless it's a huge misdirect, which I don't think.
What?
It is. So the episode title is Stuck in the Middle with You. So I'm assuming that means something. And so I guess if this is the director or whoever the director is that is going to be homage, is this fully kind of meta level of, like, you know, because Richard was in that episode as an actor changing channels, you know, with the different television sets and stuff like that that they were on. Is this that level of absurd, or is it kind of a more a subtle thing? Is there anything you're allowed to say there?
I would say that it's not an absurd homage. It is not a meta. It's not stepping into a totally different world that then gets reset. No, this is the supernatural world. The things that happen are happening. It's in the way that we're telling the series of events and how it's happening.
Cool.
I wish I could say more, but all I can really say is I think this is one that people, if you're a fan of the show that going way back, you're really going to want to watch it. And if you're a fan and you're a new fan and you're, you know, liking what we're doing this season, you're really going to want to watch it too, because, of course I got to be my own hype man, but even if I wasn't, the one who wrote this, it would be like the one I tell people, like, you got to watch this episode. It's just really cool what we're doing. Yeah.
Is there anything that you can say about, you mentioned the sort of the episodes you watched to prep for American Nightmare. Is there any episodes of Supernatural that you watched to prep for this one?
Yes, definitely.
Which, any that you can name at all?
I definitely watched episodes to prep for this. I don't want to say too much because I think the further down the line I get and the more specific I get, I might say something that'll reveal too much. So I did my homework.
Fair enough.
And yeah.
What's your then very, very quickly before we move on to Ariana and American Crime, as we are getting pretty chatty here. I mean, I don't have anywhere to be, but I don't want to torture you all night. What has been your favorite thing? Because this is, you know, your first time writing Castiel. I'm not sure if Mary and Crowley are also in this episode, but what's your favorite thing as a fan and observer, you know, that gets to have input about Sam, Dean, and Cass?
I enjoy when two things. I enjoy when Cass is sort of a fish out of water and feeling like a man isolated from the people that understand him, mm-hmm. you know? And the other thing I enjoy is when Cass subconsciously and isn't even aware of it is feeling emotion, you know, because mm-hmm. he's this angel who's supposed to be this kind of stoic figure, but the guys are able to affect him emotionally. Mm. And I think Misha does a great job of as an actor, it's hard to teeter that line between always being this, you know, semi-robotic character, but you also want to react off of the things that are in front of you and have, you know, most of what you learn as an actor is to work off of another person. And then you say, no, your character would never. So I like it more when there's a nuance in the relationship between Castiel and Sam and Dean. And so for me, peeling back the layers and showing just how important that relationship really is to everyone involved was something I wanted to do.
Awesome. That's the biggest question. I didn't tweet before we got on the call that I was doing this because I always get paranoid about things falling through. But I just put out asking for a question of the day, which is a segment we do at the end. And I've got a great one, actually, from, you'll see. But the thing that people were asking was like, ask him about the Cass-centric episode. Has he met Misha? Another one. I'd love to know if he's met Misha yet and if he will get a chance to write Cass this season. So there you go. Like, that's definitely of high interest. So,
good.
Yeah.
I will say it again. And this is, you know, a direct quote that I'm stealing from Andrew. Cass is very much a center of this story and very important to the drive of this story, what's happening.
Cool. Awesome. All right. So I think that we can probably move on away from Supernatural for a little moment there and throw back to some of the stuff that Ariana wanted to talk about with American Crime. So sorry, Ariana, I hope that you've enjoyed us listening to talk for half an hour about this show that you've seen one episode of.
No, I mean, it was actually really interesting to listen because even though I only seen one episode, it's really interesting getting into the thought process of how you guys come up with this stuff and what you decide and end up choosing to write. But yeah, I'm back now. My name's Ariana. Natalie made me sound much cooler than I actually am. I'm not from Los Angeles. I live here, but I'm from Bakersfield, which you might know.
So oh, yeah.
Yeah. So, yeah, it's infamous. and too much like American Crime's town in season
very,
two.
Very, yeah, it's very Modesto meets, you know, the Indiana town. It's a nice little cross-section of our two seasons, I would say.
It is, right. Heartland right there. But American Crime has become this really critically acclaimed show with really beautiful storytelling, but it also has a lot of diversity both on, but even more unusual off screen, in the writer's room and in terms of the directors that they choose. So I just kind of wanted to ask, what was your experience in the American Crime writer's room? And how does it compare to your overall experience as a Latino in Hollywood, which we kind of talked about earlier, but how does it compare and what
ways? Of course.
Ways?
Well, the American Crime Writers Room, I have to give a lot of credit. I mean, if not all the credit to Michael McDonald, who's the non-writing executive producer, and John Ridley, who's the, you know, creator, auteur, writing executive, producer, showrunner, because it was something that they consciously engaged and went after. It was, you know, a lot of times when you're looking to put together a room, I've never put together a room, so I'm speaking anecdotally, you look towards the usual names that people give you, or you look towards the other successful shows that have just, you know, ended their run. And so you go to that same well of names of people that can do the job. And I think what Michael and John did very well was say, no, we want to get people, we're going to ask and we're going to call agents and we're going to, you know, we're going to make them give us other names. We're going to ask for scripts from people that are of color and Latino and Asian and female. And we're going to get the best team together, but we're going to specifically engage a very wide net because we want to be including these voices in the show. And me specifically, you know, I got into the ABC writing program, and part of that, you go on this kind of round robin meeting the producers that have overall deals with the studio. And one of my first meetings was with Michael McDonald. And it just so happened that, you know, stepping back to that first program in 2009 when I was an assistant, he was one of the creative executives at the studio at the time. And so we kind of instantly bonded. And I just was like, hey, I used to get you coffee for the weekly meeting. He kind of laughed. And we had this really great conversation about my background as a kid and sort of being a high school dropout and being a little bit of a delinquent, you know, and luckily for me, I figured it all out, you know, and I had a family that was very loving and supportive, and I had community around me and people that helped me through that time. And a lot of people don't have that. And that's how they kind of end up in certain situations where it takes them a while to figure things out, or they never figure things out. And Michael responded to that, and he was very excited and was, you know, you have to meet John Ridley because, you know, we're working on this pilot, American Crime, and you basically just pitched us Tony, you know, who's this character. I think I had read the script at that point. So maybe some of me sharing that was very targeted, or maybe it was organically coming out of me, but I knew that it directly tied into the kind of story they were telling. And then, you know, I met with John, and that meeting again went really well. Shared with him again, sort of very candidly, some of those things. And I think, what John responded to, and this is just my own opinion, but I think it's pretty accurate, was the genuine nature of my experience and the, you know, the truth that this is what somebody actually went through. It wasn't a story that you're creating. It wasn't a book that you read. It was something that you experienced firsthand, and there's truth in it. And that's how I got, you know, that first writing assignment. And, you know, on that show in particular, you know, we read a lot of books and watched documentaries and met and talked with people that were actual individuals that have dealt or are dealing with the stories and the types of stories that we were telling. And the writer's room was just a gift. You know, I think everyone was just from day one, you know, I think John set a tone that was very open and honest, and everyone was just very comfortable sharing these very candid life experiences. And you just trusted everybody, and you trusted that you were in a safe space, and that we were just really building towards something really great.
Wow. So I know, I'm like, this sounds so beautiful. So clearly you had a really positive experience here. Do you Absolutely. Feel like Hollywood as a whole, do you feel positive about the way things are going?
You know, it's funny. I get asked that question or a version of that question fairly frequently, as far as, you know, in the face of such, you know, it's so much a lack of our voices being heard. You know, do you feel that we're making progress, or how do we make progress? And for me, I take that as a personal level, because If I allowed myself to open up to the negative point of view on it, the facts that there is a low percentage of Latin voices, that there is for some reason barriers to our entry, and that we're sort of asked to outperform and then expected to never fail, you know, I would get bogged down pretty quickly. So what I tend to do and try to do is just really internalize and focus on the self and say, for me, I have to just believe that I'm making progress and that I'm doing my best work, and that I'm at every meeting, at every interaction, going to bring the best of myself. And if this person can't see that or doesn't want to see that, that's their failing, not my failing. My writing and my output is going to speak for itself. I'm very fortunate in the writing jobs that I've gotten from American Crime and Supernatural. You know, American Crime is that auteur television, inclusive storytelling. And then now Supernatural is this, you know, longest running American sci-fi show, an established show with a built-in audience, 23 episode, more of the traditional, you know, type of storytelling. I'm getting to diversify, and I'm getting to cast my net wide, and I'm going to build on those opportunities for myself, if only for that someday I could have my own show. And then when it's my turn to hire my writing staff, I can do what John did for me. And I could say, no, I don't want that same five list of guys. Give me those other voices. I want the women. I want the women of color. I want the over 50 men. I want the Latinos. And I might have to meet a little bit more. I might have to read a little bit more. And ultimately, I might hire the expected voice here and there, or I might hire the friend that I made on a show who's, you know, not your typical inclusive or diverse kind of candidate. But I will be damn sure that I also hire those other people that aren't getting those opportunities that they should be getting.
American Crime is obviously so specifically aimed and focused at that kind of thing. Ariana sent me the article about John that said that American Crime should basically be taken as an example of how to get it right if the ACLU ever did an investigation in hiring practices. And I think that all of that stuff behind the scene is so amazing. And I don't... Like, Supernatural is obviously not the focus of the show. That's not exactly the kind of stories they're telling. It's not about, you know, like, especially right. Season one of American Crime, to my knowledge, is very much the stories were about, you know, race and class and all of those things that were not, you know, it's not just incidental that those people were on screen. That's what the story was about. But Supernatural does... I always appreciate for the show being what it is, for it being, you know, a lighter entertainment, you know, about a couple of white guys. I have noticed the ongoing normalization in that environment of women and of people of color in roles that don't have to be women or people of color, if you know what I mean. They are very incidental. And I was wondering where those decisions get made, if it's just generic open casting, if you're specifically like, hey, that guy, your episode, I think, had two, both the priest and the social worker were both of color characters that really in another show, if they hadn't bothered to cast them as of color, like totally normalized, that they wouldn't have had to be. So I was wondering like where those kind of decisions get made.
Well, I would say that thankfully, you know, the Supernatural production group here seems to be a little bit more woke these days and aware.
Yeah.
But for me, like specifically to point out the examples you mentioned, in my script for the priest, I specifically put Asian.
Okay.
Yep. And that was from a personal I wanted to put some diversity in there, and also being raised Catholic and on occasion going to church, you know, on Christmas and New Year's, I have found that there's certain communities that still are heavily practicing Catholicism, and it tends to be the Latin community and the Asian community for some reason. Maybe that's my own, you know, misunderstanding of just the neighborhoods I'm going to, but that's just
I agree. I saw the Asian priest and I was like, oh yeah.
Yeah. You know, you're like, Yeah. It's very typical to see the Asian priest in the Latin church. And you're just like, and I wanted to just put that little bit of myself into that. As far as the Beth character, that was a character that I just said, here's a name, and I didn't specify race or anything. If it were up to me, all the last names would be Latin, but I know that you can't do that either. Then it becomes kind of comical at that point. It's like, oh, every other character besides the guys is a Latin character, which actually might be a good idea for an episode. But
there's certainly communities like that. They go to enough towns where, like, you know, it would be, you know, a certain community that they would be in. But,
right,
yeah.
Down Dia de los Muertos on my whiteboard. But
have you guys not had that episode yet? That seems kind of
I don't think so. Silly. But, season 13.
Next year.
They never. They no, I don't think so.
I think they do a good job actually of not. I think apart from maybe the Banshee episode, they don't. Maybe I'm wrong in this, but that it doesn't seem that they'd go for the cultural or the tourism of it all. That, you know, even when they had the Aztec monster as a character, it was very much just still the supernatural world. It didn't go into the. But it would be interesting if they did have to maybe go into some kind of southwesty town that was not your typical.
Yeah, they had
like a ghost town.
Yeah.
They had one where everyone's name that was the like literally a southern town, as in like a town hung up on the like Civil War, if you know what I mean. And that was hilarious because they were like, "What the hell is wrong with these people?" But I feel like Supernatural has a relatively liberal worldview. It's not an issues based show, you know, like American Crime, but the small things that they are saying and presenting, like, you know, the opinions, like who Sam and Dean thinks is a douchebag versus who they think is fine, or like the things that, you know, and then, as I said, a lot of the normalized casting, you know, women in positions of power, like being sheriffs or doctors or whatever, like the people that they meet incidentally are quite diverse and quite normalized, and you have that aspect versus a show like American Crime, which is so specifically about the representation, you know, addressing that the issues that people of certain backgrounds do face. So was it kind of tough to go from, I don't want to say this in like a condescending way, but was it tough to go from something that was like so quote unquote important to something that was like a lot lighter, if you know what I mean? Sorry, that's really terrible.
No,
I hope you know what I mean. Like,
no, I mean, look, I understand the point you're making, and for me, it wasn't a very difficult transition as a writer because, you know, it was something I pursued and was very grateful for the opportunity. And in the bigger scheme of things, it was important for my career to solidify my position as a writer here in this town, to diversify my craft. Mm-hmm. And also, I want to write genre. And so to write genre, you need to show that you can write genre.
Yeah,
sure. And so, you know, in those elements. But as far as like the content, I actually think what we're doing, and this might be Pollyanna-ish or totally my own sort of naivete, but, you know, if you can tell someone a story and entertain them and get them engaged in this world where, on the subconscious level, like you said, there's these characters where it's a female sheriff or it's an Asian priest, and you're not, you know, being confronted in a direct kind of way. You're just kind of open to it. And over time, you know, you might start to see the world a little differently. You might start to understand that the world is a bigger place than the town that you're from. And also, you know, as far as the show having a liberal worldview, I think that probably is in the writing. You know, I think a lot of us as writers, as creative types, have liberal mentalities, and that will seep into the characters some. But I think what Supernatural has done really well, and what I'm actually kind of proud of it for, is that it doesn't isolate one group over the other. Hmm. You know, I think there was a recent poll, and I wish I could say specifically where, but it asked like conservatives, you know, what's your favorite shows? And it asked liberals, what's your favorite shows? And Supernatural was among the top three for both groups.
Yeah.
You know, And so that, to me, says, okay, here we are. We're in a space where we have the ear of both individuals. Why not try to show some commonality? Why not try to get that communication going? Why not try to get people to understand each other versus all the dissidents and all the other, you know, discord that's happening, all the polarization that's happening. Mm. You know, if you're a Supernatural fan, you're a part of the SPN family, and there's a commonality there, you know.
See, I really love that, because that's the kind of the stuff like American Crime, for example, or many other shows, you know, something like, I don't know, like Orange is the New Black, various shows that are really, you kind of go in knowing that they're like heavily issues based, that they're based about race or sexuality or something like that. A lot of the audience going in already knows what they want, or they know what you're telling them, if you know what I mean. They might know this, not know the specifics, but they're already of the mindset to be compassionate to those kind of things. Whereas something like Supernatural, which might have a wider audience or a more casual audience, they're more able to like learn from normalization, I think, if that makes sense, rather than like,
yeah, you open your mind and you know, and you know, even if you're completely never experienced, you know, another type of individual, if they're on your favorite show and they're an integral part of the case of the week, and you kind of go, oh, that's kind of cool and that's interesting.
Like last season, towards the end, there was an episode that had Sam and Dean meeting a couple of hunters on a job that were a white guy and a Latino guy, a married couple. And no one batted an eyelid. Like, it wasn't, the guys weren't like, oh my God, you're gay hunters.
Right,
like it was just like, oh yeah, cool. And they even like invited them to come and keep working with them. And like, I'm like, wow, shocker. Not for me, obviously, but like the fact that like someone who voted for Donald Trump might watch that episode and just be like, well, they're not making a big deal of it and they're cool and drive cars and have guns and stuff. So,
You know, hunters, you know, hunters are good.
It's really interesting. So, anyway, we'll carry on going into gripes. Very, very quickly talk about some of those. One of mine would be very quickly is Catholic guilt, because you're you've mentioned several times that that's sort of a part of your upbringing that has influenced the writing. And this episode of Supernatural, you know, leaned more heavily on it than any, I think, than a lot of the episodes have in the past. The Supernaturals had a lot to do with, you know, Judeo-Christian religion concepts, you know, God and angels and stuff. But the whole, like, the stigmata, like, the issues of, you know, these people's actions being influenced by God is really interesting to me. And just that whole thing of the people who do have any involvement in Catholicism, like I went to a Catholic school, versus those who do not. How even if you're not really religious, you know, or don't participate or don't even like logically believe in God, if you're agnostic or atheist, if you know the culture, it kind of creates a different like worldview and how that colors your life. So I was just wondering about the involvement in that in the writing.
Yeah, no, I mean, I was raised Catholic and, you know, I went to Catholic school till I think 10th grade. When I got kicked out for being, a delinquent. Wow. Then I went to public school after that. But, you know, it's funny because there's a lot that, you know, I can poo-poo on it about as far as the repression and the guilt and the, you know, the very visceral kind of self-loathing that it tends to create in individuals. But there's actually a lot of positive that I got out of it, too. You know, I think the spirituality and the for me, you know, if you look at like Christianity as far as like the Protestant version or the Baptist version, and then you look at Catholicism, there's a mysticism to it.
Oh, yes.
And I love that about it. And I think, you know, one of the first, I think I said it in an interview and I might have posted it somewhere, but one of the first scary books I ever read was the Book of Revelation, you know. and you go into a Catholic church and you look on the walls and there's this like the Stations of the Cross and there's like the bloody Christ and you're like, oh my God, it's like a horror movie inside the church. And what are the secrets of the, you know, the what is the Holy Trinity and what is the the mysteries of faith and all of that kind of really cool esoteric kind of stuff was born out of my Catholic upbringing. And I have a wholly, totally different and unique sort of point of view on what this thing called God is or might be, and what, you know, what that means for me in my life and spiritual enlightenment. But it started with Catholicism. So to a degree, you know, I think it was the people. And I think it really goes back to a lot of what we're talking about. It's you can take any concept, any religion, any movement, and it can start from a really genuine kind of place with, you know, a really great intention. And then the people that get involved with that twist it to their own means, and it's sad. You know, it's human nature to sort of try to get as much as you can out of something and make it work for you, versus taking a step back and saying, no, how is this supposed to work for others? How is this supposed to work for my community? And how do I take an individual responsibility in that community to make this work for that? You know, I'm not trying to preach the gospels, and I'm not trying to make the case for there being a higher power. Mm. All I can say is for me in my life, you know, it's been a blessing and a curse. And I think that's a great paradox to sort of even explain the existence of humanity.
Mm. Well, that's kind of what was the most interesting to me about your episode that we saw of Supernatural, the heavy religious influences and the implication of, you know, what the show Supernatural is trying to say about religion, and more what it's trying to say about humanity, because every episode of Supernatural so far in season 12 has had some sort of focus of the, like, even if there's a monster involved, even if there's a supernatural being involved, even if that supernatural being has killed people, it has more than ever before, Supernatural is sort of being like, okay, the human involved in this story is the twisted one. And we had both the mother in your episode and then the reveal at the end of the British Men of Letters killing Magda, right, which Sam and Dean would not have done, which really put down that really kind of threw down the glove of, okay, they are, their level of what is like killable is very different to Sam and Dean's, because so far we knew they were twisted, but we knew they were kind of harsh, but we didn't know if they were just killing, you know, vampires, but killing them more harshly than Sam and Dean do. No, they are killing someone who Sam and Dean would deem innocent. And so that whole humanity is the real problem. Is that, you know, an ongoing theme of this season intentionally, or has it just sort of been a coincidence with the episode?
Maybe a little bit of both. I mean, I think I know intentionally for this season, we wanted to make the stories more personal and more about the people involved and not necessarily about the bigger overarching meta story. You know, even in the meta story that we're telling with the British Men of Letters and also with, you know, Lucifer sort of being without a vessel, we're making sure that that's not necessarily driving or distracting from the things that are happening in the now. Mm. You know, what it's going to be about is how are these characters, as real people, as fleshed out individuals, as human beings, dealing with, reacting to, and affecting each other. You know, and there's, you know, there's a storyline. I don't know if you, I'm pretty sure people have noticed it, but we've made it also conscious decision to flesh out the existing hunter world that Sam and Dean are very, very much a part of, but we don't see too much of, you know.
Very curious about that, yes, because my theory is because that's obviously what they were wanting, what the British Men of Letters were like, hey, I want to be linked into this, and Sam and Dean aren't that involved with it, and I'm wondering if they might end up forming their sort of own Dumbledore's army against the British Men of Letters, like, oh, we actually should get this hunter community involved to get these people to stop being so gross, or something like that.
But, you know, that sounds like a really good idea. I should probably pitch it to Andrew. Yeah. I don't know. I can't really like speak
I already wrote an article theorizing about this. This is what I do. So I know you can't tell me if it's true or not, but that's certainly my theory that the reveal of the various hunter community is very, very important, and that it's all going to come together. So like that Steve Yockey episode about Asa Fox, I felt like that was the start of something pretty huge, like that it grew the world outwards quite a lot. So that's something I'm interested in. But
right. You know, and also, I mean, yeah. Just because you brought it up, the thing with Magda and Mr. Catch.
Yes.
That was kind of, it was tough for me in a way to write, because I really enjoyed creating the character of Magda, it was a very personal story that I was telling there, and I was trying to be sensitive to a lot of different factors of her journey, and you know, but also knowing that we had already planned to, we're introducing this character who is just a son of a bitch, you know, and everything that you touched on is correct. It's drawing the line between Sam and Dean able to see the gray areas, able to see the nuances, able to make the little bit of wiggle room for people, and the British Men of Letters just coming in and saying, no, the world is black and white. You killed somebody, you die. You have this, you die. You're a monster, you die. I really was like, I tried. I was like, is there any version where they take her psychic power and she's still alive? And then it ultimately I had to say, look, you know, I was also very sensitive to the fact that, you know, historically in fiction and in television and in film, there's this thing where you kill the girl to make the guy feel something, and it's all about the guy. And I was like, but this wasn't that. This was someone's journey.
I mean, then they don't even know about that yet. You know, Sam and Dean, I don't know if they will find out about that, like as part of the wider Men of Letters plot, but. Yes, it was certainly discussed with the fans about like the whole, oh, she's been killed. It was
right.
Very
and then also,
you,
look, to make the case for, you know, how I sort of wrap my head around it, it's still, as you can tell, I'm like really conflicted about it. It's she did kill two people.
Still. I understand story wise why she had to die. It was to prove the gravity.
Let me step it back. As a writer, what I did was I was able to justify Mr. Catch's choice because in his worldview, she killed two people.
Yes.
And so and as a writer who sometimes has to accept the rules of the universe you're creating, you know, I was able to say, okay, well, just because me as an individual, as a person – would want her to live, you know, that's not the story I'm telling.
True. That's fair enough. I'm curious about whether they would deem just anyone with a psychic power who hadn't killed anyone also the same level of like, oh, you're not human, there you gotta die, or if they know that about Sam and if whether he would be in trouble, but I'm sure that those kind of things may or may not come up later, so I'm just curious.
Well, I can say that the what they know about Sam and Dean is only what's, you know, sort of been able to be scraped together by fringe news stories and by FBI files or by any sort of long distance research that they could have done.
Yeah.
So most of the personal type of information has yet to be or may not be revealed. I can say that. And as far as how they operate, it is very much you know, if someone were psychic, as long as we didn't know your, like the don't ask, don't tell, you know?
Okay.
Well, if you're not using your abilities and we don't know you're psychic, then you're not a problem. But the minute it comes out and it's a bad thing for our community, then we're going to be all over you. And you know, they have very hard and fast rules, the British Men of Letters. It's, you know, it's how they've been able to establish their dominance over in the UK and keep monster outbreaks from happening over in the UK, and it's the type of hunting and type of mentality they're trying to import into the US, and we'll see how well that works for them.
Is that, are they present in 1212 at all?
No comment.
Fair enough. Okay. We'll hand over to Arianna just to finish up talking about these writing programs, because I think it's something people, as we said, don't really know about but are very interested in. And then we'll just do our little closing piece and let you go. So it's been really awesome. I hope that people enjoy it. But yeah, Arianna, I know nothing about this. So you guys talk about this.
Yeah, so just really quick, different studios and different networks have programs. Like there's the Disney one, the Nickelodeon one, CBS, NBC, and they're all different varying levels of, I guess, like success. Like
prestige?
Some are right. more hands. No, not prestige. I mean, I guess some are just more hands-on than others. And right. it seems like the ABC one is pretty hands-on. So do you want to talk about that?
I'm aware of the other programs and have had friends that have gone through them, and I don't know specifically what their processes are like, but I can tell you for ABC, it's, I think, one of the only, if the only one, that actually pays you for the year that you're committed to being in the program. So you can quit your day job, you can stop worrying about where the checks are coming from, and focus primarily on your writing and building your network. And what they did for us in the first, you know, month or two was work with how we're promoting ourselves and how we're speaking about ourselves, how we're pitching ourselves in a room, our personal life story, and how to condense that into a 2-minute chunk before you lose someone's attention in a meeting, you know? And then they also worked on our samples and gave notes on how to make those samples more engaging, and then set up a ton of meetings, you know, with people that had existing relationships with ABC Studios. And that's how I met, you know, or reconnected with Michael McDonald, because of that sort of session of meetings. And they also set you up with a mentor who's an experienced showrunner and kind of just is there for you to talk about and ask questions. And they're not going to hire you. They're not going to put you on their show, but they're there to kind of guide you through some things. And then if you just want to express any kind of angst about anything writerly, you know, this experienced person is there for that year that you're in the program. And while they're paying you on a weekly salary, what happens is if any of the shows, any of the new pilots or the shows that are coming back decide after meeting with you that you're a great addition to their room, the budget for your services don't come out of the show. It comes out of that weekly salary that the program is already paying you. So in essence, there's an incentive for writers' rooms that might have a need to include one of these program writers as part of their staff. I'm still in very close contact with, you know, the people that run the program. They're still very much advocates for me. I've been invited back to speak on a couple panels that they've sponsored. And so they're very much involved in your success, even after you're in the program. And I can't speak about any of the other studios and how those processes work, but I can't say enough good things about the ABC program.
So just to break it down for people who have literally never heard this before, like me, in 30 seconds, what is this? So it is a writing, a year-long, like a training, like, thing or run by the network to foster talent, and how do you apply?
I wouldn't call it a training. What it is a they used to call it, I guess, a diversity program, but now it's a inclusive program, and all it really is a platform for writers that are on the cusp or having a difficulty getting to that next level in their career. So it could be you've staffed on a show, but then nothing ever happened for you again. It could be that you're an assistant and you've just, you know, are struggling and you just need a breakthrough. Or it could be that you're a really prolific writer and you're, you know, out of state and you're just really trying to have a reason to come here to Los Angeles, and you know, you need a reason to move here and know that there's going to be a safety net when you arrive.
Yes.
To get into the program requires a knowledge of television and how it's made, a knowledge of the kinds of stories that are being told on screen right now. An existing network certainly helps, because then they know that there's certain people that they can call right away that'll also get on board with advocating for you. It's not a prerequisite, you know. They've certainly brought in people that don't know anyone at all, but it helps to set you and them up for success if you can say, look, I've already been doing some of the work. You know, I've already met with this person. I have this agent who really likes me, or I have this showrunner's assistant or showrunner that I get coffee with. And, you know, just to show them that, you know, like for me, I applied, I think, 4 years before I got in. And
so you applied
each year
four
I learned,
times in a row, basically.
Yeah. And each time I learned a little bit more about my own writing and about my own branding, and also myself as a creative person and a professional. And I got to the point, in an ironic kind of way, I got to the point where I almost didn't apply that fourth time, because I was, it was a little bit about that sort of egotistical funk of like, oh, I'm just so tired of the rejection. But also, you know, I was working for Noah Hawley, and I saw that there was a path there. He was a very great mentor-like individual, and I was learning a lot, and I was satisfied creatively, and so I kind of was just enough steam behind me. Little did I know that that's kind of what actually helped to make me a better candidate, because they saw, okay, well, here's a writer who, if we didn't interject, maybe in like 3 or 4 years, he might break through. However, if we step in now, we just save that writer 3 or 4 years, and then we just help them to leap forward into that next level of their career. A little bit of that confidence in myself, confidence in my ability, and just confidence in where I was going, kind of helped push me forward and make, I think, my application a little bit better. And then also in the interview process, I went from being this needy, sweaty, kind of hungry, please help me individual to just connecting on a very personal and sincere level, you know? And I think that's what they want. They want a sincere, honest, self-aware voice that they can champion and get behind and help get a job.
Cool. As I said, this isn't my field at all. It is Ariana. So Ariana, was there anything that you wanted to talk about, like with that, any questions or any of your experience?
Not really. It's just really cool to meet someone who went through the program, because, so like Natalie, he says that, I mean, really, like, anybody can apply, and thousands do, but then they select like 10 people.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
You are a special snowflake.
Oh, I appreciate that. I would rather be a snowflake than a cuck.
Mm-hmm.
That's a personal joke. I think like 2 people will understand what that means.
That's we're running pretty short on time, so we'll close up now just with our final little segment. In my email I mentioned the 2 truths and a lie just as a fun segment. Did you have those at all for us? Cool. So
I do.
As that's a regular part of this show, so we get our guest or our lead host to do 2 truths and a lie. So Davey's gonna read us his 2 truths and a lie, and we will guess the correct answer.
Okay. So my 2 truths and a lie are directly related to my episode American Nightmare.
Awesome.
So hopefully if you've watched it, it'll make more sense that you can make these guesses.
Mm-hmm.
In no particular order, here they are. The first one is that the name Magda is a direct nod to one of my sisters.
Mm-hmm.
The second one is that Magda was originally supposed to be Lucifer's next vessel, but then when we cast Rick Springfield, we wanted to use him more.
Mm-hmm.
And so we had to change the story for that reason. And the next one is there was a scene cut from the script. It was cut for time, but it was a scene where Dean was driving back to the farm at night pissed at himself that he separated from Sam.
I think
the second one is a lie.
The Lucifer?
Yes.
I think the second one might be a lie purely because I think the last one is true because it was the one criticism I heard of the episode of, like, that we didn't see that transition of Dean getting back to Sam. So I think that the last one is true. The Rick Springfield thing has been happened for a long time, so I don't know how far in advance this was written of that. So I'm not sure. I'll say the first one is a lie just to be different from Ariana, and one of us can win or one of us can lose.
So these are final answers?
Yeah.
Yes.
Okay. So the last one was true. There was a scene in the script that showed Dean driving back to the farm, and he was kind of outwardly upset that he had some kind of line in there that said that he should never separate from Sam. Mm. But because of time and production and story-wise, we cut it, and we actually never shot the scene. Mm. And felt, you know, ultimately with the way things were going, while the scene was maybe missed, it didn't necessarily bring the entire episode down enough for us to warrant shooting that. The other truth is that the name Magda is a direct nod to one of my sisters. Mm-hmm. So my sister Cynthia Magdalena is her middle name. So that would make the Lucifer's vessel the lie. Yes, that is correct. She was never meant to be a vessel for Lucifer.
That's probably good for her. Instead, she just gets to be dead. No, thank you for sharing those. I'm sure people will be excited, particularly as I mentioned that last one about Dean, because it is the only thing I have seen people say critically about that episode is the time jump of missing where Dean was during that time.
Well, yeah, I mean, I think it was also kind of hard to get a sense of how far the farm was from the main city. Yeah. And it was always intended to be on, like, you know, an hour to 2 hours away.
Okay,
like on
that
the
makes fringes. Sense. Yeah, yeah, totally.
And there might have even been a line at one point that we also, you know, somehow got lost in the revisions that was, yeah, I think it was Beth saying, oh, they live, you know, far outside of town.
Yeah, no, fair, totally yeah. fair.
Yeah, and then sometimes, you know, those lines feel a little on the nose, and so you just kind of take them out, and then you realize maybe we shouldn't have taken it out. I don't know.
No, it was so good.
So people can rest assured they their spider senses were tingling for a right reason, because there was this intention, and Dean was in fact driving mad out there somewhere, and they can film that scene in their minds.
Cool.
It's canon.
All right.
It's canon.
Cool.
Yes.
And then just finally, our question of the day before we let Davey go very, very quickly, which is just always a piece of feedback that everyone on the show answers. Our question today is from, as I mentioned earlier, Andrew's PA Megan, MegFitz89, who has asked me to ask you.
Wait,
Andrew,
this is her question?
Yeah. What's the most obnoxious thing you do to a coworker, including but not limited to things on their desk? So I feel like there might be a story here.
Oh, I might have a habit of moving things, changing the angle of screens, rearranging baskets, and then sometimes just kicking things for no reason. All in good fun, of course. But
just absent-mindedly.
Oh no, it's all intentionally to be a pest, of course. There's nothing absent-minded about it. It's all with malicious intent. I will walk up and then start grabbing brass brads and then tangling them up, or grabbing Funko Pops and putting them in interesting positions. And but, you know, also just if you're looking at a monitor, the monitor may turn away from you all of a sudden.
Wow. So you guys all go to work like at the same – you like it, all of production like meets every day at the office, and you just all work on your various things there. That's fun.
Yeah. I mean, we come in and, you know, it's sort of, various schedules and, you know, we're all here at a certain point, but some of us come early, some of us come a little later, and then some of us leave at different times, but we're all here for a good chunk of time during the day.
My most obnoxious thing I do at my workplace, oh, I don't know, what do I do to you guys that's obnoxious, Arianna? At my workplace at the university where I work, my co-worker there and I have this thing where she's super happy and cheerful and always tries to hug me, and then I pretend I don't like fun and I just like hold my arms to my side and like no, I don't want to do this. Like, she always like tries to plan parties, and so like I'm the really grumpy one, and we have like an act going on about that where I'm really, really grumpy, though I am quite grumpy. So that's probably the most intentionally obnoxious that I am, is that little game. Arianna, do you have any terrible behavior like this? Do we do this at all on Hypeable?
Absolutely not. I'm delightful, and you can take that to my interviewers.
Yeah.
I am very delightful to work with.
Yeah.
All future interviewers listening to this podcast will know that Arianna is extremely delightful to work with and does not have any obnoxious tendencies any workplace.
No, whatsoever. No naughty workplace behavior. Arianna is a genius, so they should definitely hire.
Yeah, she is. Whereas I am a complete and horrible terror with very bad habits, and am lucky to have anyone even remotely interested in wanting to spend time with me.
Yeah, that was really, really awesome to talk. And we kept you a little longer than expected, so I'm sorry about that. But I hope that you had fun and that you enjoyed talking with us.
Absolutely. Like I said, I am too garrulous for my own good sometimes, so you giving me the platform to hear myself talk has been very fun.
Awesome.
I hope you have enough to engage people with, and that they're interested and excited by all the things we've talked about.
I hope so too. Very much do. I'm very interested anyway, and I think people will be really happy to hear from you, and I'm very, very excited for 12/12, so congratulations on that. They're moving ahead with season 3 of American Crime as well, and I don't suppose you can do double duty between the two shows.
Oh, I wish I could.
Is that common? Do people ever do that? Do they write for more than one show at once?
Depending on scheduling, yeah. No, if you have two anthology short order type shows, or if your hiatus lines up with the needs of another show. Unfortunately, that did not happen for me in this case. Yeah. But I know a little, not too much. I know a little of what they have planned, and it's going to be really, really cool and really an engaging and, again, just sort of interesting in-depth story. And I actually will give a shout out to Moises. I think Zamora. I'm giving someone a shout out. I can't remember his last name. That's horrible. But he was someone that I was teaching a workshop, and he was one of the students there. And as I was transitioning to Supernatural and American Crime got picked up, they were looking to find new voices. And I immediately said, here's this guy, you got to meet him, he's really talented. And I was so proud of him that he went out and he got that job. So yeah, wow. It's Moises Zamora will be writing one of the new season 3 episodes. Definitely look out for that.
Cool. And yeah, so we'll let you go. Thank you so much for having us. We'll look forward to 12/12 of Supernatural. Nothing else at all you can tell us about that? Not one tiny word, I suppose?
I will say, okay, I was being coy earlier about the British Men of Letters, and I will say that their presence will certainly be acknowledged, and we won't sort of have the amnesia of them being part of the story. But I don't think their presence will be missed, because the events of the episode, hopefully will be, so immediate and engaging. Mm. And, if you're, I'm trying to dance around something that I just wish I could blurt out, because it's really, important episode, and I hope people will not hate me and see what I was going for.
Oh, God.
And I hope that they enjoyed as much as I have.
Oh, God.
And just
he's gonna kill Cass, Natalie. Why you're gonna hate him.
Have your best friend on speed dial, make some popcorn, get your favorite slippers on, and watch it live, is what I'll say. Don't let Twitter ruin it.
I'm in Australia. This is really terrible. Now you've got to send me a screener.
And that's all I'll say. And I think people will enjoy it. And hopefully they'll enjoy it. And if not, you know, I'm just, there's certain to have my inbox be blowing up as the episode airs.
Wow. I don't know. I mean, everyone on the show's died like 5 times. And it doesn't usually happen in the middle of a season. But, you know, it could be a shocker. Now I'm very stressed. And we've got such a huge break. We're about to have like a 6-week or more supernatural hiatus.
This episode, it won't air till like February 9th.
Great. Yeah. Okay.
We'll get to speculate until then what the heck I was talking about.
Yeah, I'm really curious about what this one big thing is and if there's going to be like any answers to any age-old questions or if it's all brand new. So I'm sure we'll talk later at the time and scream. So yeah, that'll be fun.
I mean, anybody who's getting any kind of, if they're listening to this podcast, same advice, get your friend on speed dial, wear your favorite slippers, get a blanket, make some popcorn, just enjoy the ride.
And is this like an enjoyment thing or like a comfort, like you're going to need a support network thing?
I don't know. Interpret it how you would. All right. And try to watch it live. Don't let Twitter ruin it for you.
Okay. So it's a pretty shocker to be.
I didn't use that word. All right. And I'm not trying to overhype it. Maybe I'm just being coy because I want great ratings, but knows.
Okay. It's all good. We'll let you go, and I'm sure we'll get in touch with you at the time. I'll be writing about the show for the rest of the season as well. So yeah, thank you so much for joining us. It's been really, really, really awesome, and we're really excited to do these interviews. We've done a lot of interviews on our various shows, but to have someone come on this project, which is quite new for us and very much do the How the Sausage Gets Made thing, which is the aim when I do this kind of interview, that was exactly what I was hoping for. So thank you so much for that.
Oh, absolutely. And thank you for having me. And I look forward to being in touch again and doing this again sometime.
Awesome. Awesome. And yeah, Arianna, thank you for joining us as well, even though that you've watched one single episode of Supernatural. I'm glad that you have all those other things in common with Davey.
She watched
the best one, obviously.
Thank you. That's all I need to hear. Yes.
And then, yeah, perhaps one day you guys will hang out or something when she gets her cool job and you guys, like, just walk into each other on the street and be like, I did that podcast.
Oh, absolutely. I'm going to be interviewing for Arianna when she's showrunning her ABC series.
Yeah, cool.
I'll be coming in asking for a job.
Cool.
Sure.
All right. So we'll all say bye to you and then, hope you've enjoyed this. You can find Davey on Twitter if you want to. Davey, what is your Twitter handle? Is it just at Davey Perez or is it
DAVYPEREZ. All the E's are in the last name.
Awesome. And you can reach out and tell him what you thought of this episode of the podcast or of his American Nightmare. And you can watch American Crime if you are for something a little heavy. Season 1 is a lot heavier, a lot more violent than season 2. Season 2, I enjoyed the episode of that. I watched a lot. Season 1, I was a bit like... that bit with the pipe.
Yeah.
That bit with the pipe, I was like a very sick. Like I would just so you know, like that was very one of the most viscerally sickening scenes I've seen in a while. So,
well, I mean, yeah, I mean, not to extend the conversation, oh, but God. Like I think I've tweeted it out before. Like one of the things I enjoy doing is if I can have an effect on the audience, you know, that comes out of the story, and if I can get someone to wiggle or squirm or any kind of reaction, then I'm just happy. So that's great. Yeah. That's the best compliment you could have given me.
Yeah. There was certainly some definite shocking moments in all of the episodes of the various shows in American Nightmare and in especially that first season of American Crime. You seem to like the not shock reveals in like a dramatic way, but there are some definite. Yeah, definite things that are very.
I like the turns. I like the unexpected turns, and even in season 2 of American Crime, what I really loved about that episode was the dance sequence that was very unexpected.
Yeah,
in a different, in a very different kind of way.
And they kind of allowed it to breathe and actually gave that whole airtime. There's so many things that could be talked about, but. Yes, very great to have you. Good luck with the rest of the season. So, bye-bye, everyone.
Bye now. Bye. Thank you.